All right, so ready to dive into another fascinating case. Today's deep dive is all about evidence, and specifically when things get a little tricky with conspiracy charges.
Ah, sounds intriguing.
Yeah, it really is. We're going to be dissecting Borjanli v. United States. It's a 1987 Supreme Court case that, for anyone studying law, really clarifies some crucial concepts.
Like what?
Well, the whole thing revolves around hearsay evidence, figuring out if a conspiracy even existed in the first place, and that all-important Sixth Amendment right to confront your accuser in court.
Right. Ah, the Confrontation Clause. Yeah, huge implications there.
For sure. And Borjanli, it really sets a precedent for how these issues are handled, especially in conspiracy cases.
I'm guessing this isn't some straightforward open and shut kind of case, then.
You guess it. It all starts with, well, it almost feels like a scene from a movie, right?
Yeah.
We've got an FBI informant, Angelo Lunardo, setting up a cocaine deal with this guy, Clarence Greathouse.
Okay, so classic undercover operation.
Exactly. But here's the twist. During these initial talks, Lunardo mentions he's got a friend who wants in on the action. That friend turns out to be William Borjanli, the defendant in the case.
And I bet those conversations come back to haunt Borjanli later on, right?
Oh, absolutely. So the story unfolds. Greathouse and Borjanli, they have these recorded phone conversations, and they're supposedly talking about, how good the cocaine is, what the price should be, classic drug deal stuff.
Ah, so those recorded conversations, that's where the hearsay issue comes into play.
Bingo.
Right.
Fast forward to the actual drug transfer. It all goes down in a parking lot. FBI is watching, of course. Leonardo moves the cocaine from Greathouse's car to Borjanli's, and bam, arrests are made. They even find over 20 grand in cash in Borjanli's car. Looks pretty bad on the surface.
Yeah, pretty damning evidence right there. But I'm guessing it's not that simple.
You're catching on. Here's the thing. The prosecution, they really leaned hard on those recorded conversations between Leonardo and Borjanli. They wanted to use Leonardo's statements as evidence against Borjanli, even though Leonardo himself wasn't testifying in court.
Right, classic hearsay dilemma. You can't just bring in out-of-court statements as proof unless they fall under a specific exception.
Exactly. So, was there an exception that applied here? That's where this co-conspirator exception comes in. If Leonardo's statements were made during and in furtherance of a conspiracy, well, that could change things. But could they actually prove this conspiracy existed?
And that's where it gets really interesting. This case grapples with some fundamental questions about evidence, questions that honestly are super relevant from anyone studying law.
Like what, specifically?
Well, first off, did the prosecution have to show the conspiracy was real using evidence totally separate from Leonardo's own words? Could they use his statements to kind of prove themselves? That's a big deal, right?
Yeah, feels a little bit like a statement trying to pull itself up by its own bootstraps.
Exactly. That's a good way to put it. And that leads to the second crucial question. Could the court, when they were deciding if the co-conspirator exception even applied, could they actually look at Leonardo's statements as part of that decision-making process?
So essentially, can you use the hearsay to determine if the hearsay is admissible? It all feels very circular.
It does, doesn't it? And then, of course, there's that big constitutional question lurking in the background. By allowing these statements in, statements Borjanli couldn't cross-examine Leonardo about, did the court violate his Sixth Amendment right to confront his accuser? Big implications for the Confrontation Clause.
Yeah, big implications for fairness in our legal system as a whole. So, how did the Supreme Court ultimately rule on all of this? What were the key holdings that came out of Borjanli?
Well, get ready for this. The Supreme Court, in an opinion written by Chief Justice Rehnquist, sided with the prosecution.
No way. So, they allowed Leonardo's statements in as evidence against Borjanli.
Yeah, they did. They decided that those statements were admissible under a specific rule of evidence, Rule 801(d)(2), which is the co-conspirator exception to the rule against hearsay. And crucially, they said that the prosecution didn't have to prove a conspiracy existed using completely independent evidence.
Wait, hold on. So they could actually use the very statements they were trying to get admitted to prove the conspiracy that made them admissible in the first place. That feels like that bootstrapping problem we were talking about.
It definitely raises that question. But here's how the court justified it. They pointed to another rule of evidence, Rule 104A. This rule basically deals with, those preliminary questions judges have to answer before they can decide if a piece of evidence is even allowed in court.
So, like a judge has to make a decision before the jury even hears the evidence.
Right. And 104A says that the court, quote, is not bound by the rules of evidence except those with respect to privilege. And what the Supreme Court took that to mean was that judges can actually consider hearsay statements, even those alleged co-conspirator statements, when they're deciding if the rules for that co-conspirator exception have actually been met.
So they can use the hearsay to decide if the hearsay exception applies. Interesting.
Yeah, it's a bit of a head-scratcher. And the court specifically addressed a previous case, Glasser v. United States from 1942, that had suggested a stricter requirement for independent proof. So Borgioli really clarified that that Glasser view, that stricter view, wasn't the standard anymore because of this Rule 104A.
Gotcha. So they kind of relaxed the rules a bit, made it easier to get these co-conspirator statements into evidence. But what standard of proof did they use to determine if a conspiracy existed? Was it the beyond a reasonable doubt standard, you know, the one they need to convict someone?
Not quite. They went with a lower standard, a preponderance of the evidence standard. Basically, the judge just had to find that it was more likely than not that a conspiracy was going on.
Okay, so they didn't need to be completely certain, just more likely than not. Makes sense for these preliminary rulings, I guess. But what about the Confrontation Clause issue? How did the court square allowing those statements in with Borgioli's right to confront the witness against him? You know, Leonardo.
Right. That's the big one. Well, the court relied on a case from 1980, Ohio v. Roberts. That case said, essentially, that hearsay can be admitted without pushing the Confrontation Clause if it fits under a firmly rooted exception to the hearsay rule, or if it has particularized guarantees of trustworthiness, basically meaning it seems super reliable.
So where did the co-conspirator exception fit into all that?
Well, the Borgioli court decided that the co-conspirator exception was one of those firmly rooted exceptions. They said it's been around for a long time, so it's probably reliable enough that they didn't need to do a separate Confrontation Clause analysis.
Okay, so because it was a well-established exception, they felt comfortable skipping that extra step. A separate Confrontation Clause analysis.
Yeah, that was their reasoning back then. But it's really important to remember that the Supreme Court's thinking about the Confrontation Clause has changed a lot since then, especially after cases like Crawford v. Washington in 2004. That case really shook things up.
Makes sense. The law doesn't just stand still. But in 1987, this is how they saw it. So that covers the majority's opinion. Were there any other perspectives on the court? Any concurring or dissenting opinions we should know about?
Oh, for sure. Justice Stevens, he agreed with the majority's decision, but felt the need to clarify that bootstrapping issue we talked about.
Right, using the statement itself to prove it's admissible.
Yeah. He basically said a co-conspirator statement can be part of the mix when a judge is deciding whether to allow it in, but it can't be the only evidence they use. There has to be something else, some other evidence that backs it up. His famous line is that the statement can't, quote, lift itself into admissibility entirely by tugging on its own bootstraps.
So it could be part of the puzzle, but not the whole puzzle. What about the dissent? Was there a strong dissenting opinion?
There was. Justice Blackmun really disagreed with the whole idea that hearsay could be used to prove a conspiracy existed. He said this was messing with a key safeguard that was always part of the co-conspirator exception, the need for independent proof before those statements could even be considered.
So he thought having that separate independent evidence was really important to make sure those statements were trustworthy, to protect the defendant's rights.
Exactly. He was worried that letting hearsay prove the conspiracy would weaken the Confrontation Clause protections, make it too easy to bring in out-of-court statements that might not be reliable. He saw that circularity as a real problem.
It does get to the heart of how much we should trust these out-of-court statements, right? When someone isn't there to be cross-examined, how much weight should their words really carry? So, thinking practically, what are the big takeaways from Borgioli? How did it change things for prosecutors and defense attorneys handling conspiracy cases?
Well, for prosecutors, it definitely made things a bit easier. They don't absolutely need that independent evidence anymore to get those co-conspirator statements in. And that preponderance of the evidence standard, the fact that they can use the hearsay itself as part of that initial decision making, that definitely gives them an edge. It can streamline their case.
But for defense attorneys, it sounds like it got a bit harder to keep those statements out.
Yeah, it's a tougher battle for them. They really need to understand that Rule 104A and how that preponderance standard works. They have to focus on arguing that even if you look at that hearsay, the prosecution hasn't shown it's more likely than not that there was a conspiracy and their client was part of it. They might also try to use Justice Stevens' concurrence to their advantage, arguing that there isn't enough additional evidence besides the statement to make it admissible.
So understanding the nuances of this case, how the rules have shifted, is crucial for both sides.
Totally. And while we haven't gotten into it here, knowing how the Confrontation Clause has developed since Borgelli, you know, cases like Crawford, is also important for navigating this area of law. It's a complex landscape that's still evolving.
It really is. So for all you future lawyers out there, think about this. How has Borgelli, with its framework for handling co-conspirator statements, really shaped the strategies prosecutors and defense attorneys use in conspiracy cases? And how does the ability of the court to consider hearsay in its own admissibility ruling impact the dynamics of presenting and challenging evidence? It's a big question with no easy answers.
For sure. It's a question that cuts to the heart of how we balance the need to prosecute these complex cases with the fundamental right to a fair trial. And Borgelli is still, even today, a crucial case for understanding that balance.
Great insights as always. Thanks for joining us for another deep dive. We'll see you next time.
See you then.